Okay, what I want to do with you guys tonight I just want to just welcome a friend, Mark Raffaelli, who's been here before, but here at our class for the first time. And Mark is the president of Adaret El, which is the shul on 29th Street where we have our downtown branch. And I just told my son, because he's writing a report on the Civil War, that if you come into the synagogues, there's this, I think it's behind like a glass plane, I think on the second story. You know what I'm talking about?
In our shul?
Yeah. Because there were Jews praying in Adaret El during the Civil War. It is the oldest synagogue in its same location in Manhattan. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
So it's like landmarked and then some. And it's an amazing shul, and Mark is very, very active and very, very helpful to us in establishing our downtown program there. So welcome.
Nice to be here.
We tonight are going to uncover some really cool and interesting stuff, because Lag BaOmer is one of those holidays that most of us don't really understand, and we're here to explain it. And there's an amazing article that I'm going to read with you. I want to give you a little background before I start reading the article. It's written by a rabbi who was the executive vice president of the Orthodox Union for many years, picked up by Esha Torah on their website, and found its way to MGE for the next level class. We'll read it in a second, but don't look for a minute. Just off the bat, Lag BaOmer, a couple of questions. Happy day, sad day?
Happy day.
Why is it a happy day? What was that? What was everyone laughing at? I want to hear that.
It's a secret.
It's a secret.
I'll do Rabbi.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. You're going to get a little more of a historical perspective on Lag BaOmer today. Okay, fine. So you guys are in. But what happened on this day? Okay, so Rabbi Akiva's students who were dying during this whole period of time, the Talmud in Yevamot says that that from Atzeret, from Pesach to Atzeret, Atzeret is another way of saying Shavuos, the 12,000 zugot, the 12,000 pairs of students of Rabbi Akiva died. How did they die? Anybody know? Is that what he said?
Yeah.
So the Talmud says Azkara. So Azkara, I heard an interesting lecture today by Rabbi Neuberger. I went online. You know that all of our Torah that is taped here gets hosted by Yeshiva University. Yeshiva University has like literally tens and tens of thousands of great lectures, and I got an email about some Lag BaOmer lectures given up at Yeshiva University. So I listened to one today from Rabbi Neuberger, and Azkara is really an awful kind of stomach kind of ailment that could cause death. And they just mysteriously died during this period of time. So what is special about Lag BaOmer? So the Talmud also says, but they pasku lamut, they stopped dying on the 33rd day. So that's the obvious question. But what are we celebrating? I mean, unfortunately, we've been through a lot of things like this. Did Rabbi Reichman ask this question?
No.
They're all dead, and we're celebrating? And think about that. It's ridiculous. No, we're celebrating what?
She's saying if they're all dead, no one stopped dying. There just wasn't anybody else left to die.
It seems that way.
Exactly.
No, there weren't. No, there were many Jews left. It says that all of the students of Rabbi Akiva died. Okay, so what are we celebrating? And here's another question. Why do we have a mourning period for 32 days? How long should the mourning period be? I mean, there were more Jews that died, were killed in the Holocaust, or certainly in the Second First Temple, or in the Khmelnytsky pogroms, he asks here, and in the Crusades. We don't have 30-something days of mourning. You have one day of mourning, and when do you usually have that one day of mourning? After the event. So what do? We have 32 days of mourning, and when it's over, we celebrate. That's question number one. Question number two is really to understand the dichotomy of what's happening during the same time period. Because the Omer period, if I say Omer period, you get a positive connotation, just visceral reaction, positive or negative?
Negative.
Negative. But really, it's what? Why is it really positive? Because you're counting. Where does that come from? Where does the mitzvah to count every day come from?
Yeah.
The Torah. The Torah. Where? What period of history did this Rabbi Akiva's students take place in? In the Roman period, at least 1,000 years after the close of the Bible, much more. So it's kind of strange because during this period of joyous counting, remember the Medrash I shared with you, was it last week? About the king with his men, and he's walking in the field and they hear this terrible screaming, and they come across this hole in the ground. Nebuchadnezzar, there's a guy in there and he's yelling, and he pulls him out and he says, I'm not only going to save you, you're going to one day marry my daughter. And what does he do after he's saved? He starts to count. He's counting towards the wedding. That's the way we count. We're counting towards the wedding between God and the Jewish people. In fact, the only way to tell when Shavuos falls out is to count. It's the only holiday that doesn't have a date. Right, you only know when Shavuos is by counting from Passover, because we want to make sure that Passover, we know, is incomplete without Shavuos. The whole point of being redeemed from, you know, the Exodus is not simply to be free. It's to be free to be able to stand at Sinai and receive the Torah, hence the holiday of Shavuos and their connectedness. That is joyous. But 1,000 years later, a terrible catastrophe happens, causing this period, the same time period where we're counting with joy, and we're not getting haircuts, and we're not having weddings, and we're not going to live concerts and things like that, because it's sad. So which is it? So the answer really is both. But it also makes it a little difficult to understand. Why do we celebrate in Lag BaOmer? What exactly are we celebrating? Why are we celebrating the way we are? And how do Jews celebrate this in Israel?
Bonfires.
What's the deal with bonfires? Number one. How else did Jews celebrate this in Israel or around Israel?
Slaughter guns. Relic Russian stuff is very important.
What else? There's a place where lots of Jews go.
Meron.
They go to Meron. Who's buried in Meron?
Shimon
Bar Yochai, the great Talmudic sage who is... to whom we attribute authorship of the Zohar, the writings of Kabbalah. What's the connection with that as well? This article is going to help illuminate much of this. Follow me in the last paragraph on the page. What is the reason for sadness during what should have been a period of joyful anticipation? So the reason the Talmud tells us is 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva, who lived 1,850 years ago, died from mysterious plague. Why did they die? What is the Talmud's reason? They didn't show proper respect one to the next. Lag BaOmer celebrated on the 33rd day, because that's the day the plague ended and the students stopped dying. Right? We all know this. It leaves us with a number of difficulties. Why does this event, tragic as it is, merit 32 days? And then he goes in the same question. Why is the death of Rabbi Akiva's students given so much more weight than all of these other terrible massacres where if at all, we have one day. What's the one day that we commemorate all of Jewish tragedy?
Tisha B'Av.
In fact, when survivors of the Holocaust in the state of Israel wanted their own day to have a Holocaust Memorial Day, it met with great controversy in the rabbinic establishment. Why? Because we have a tradition that Tisha B'Av is a day to commemorate all Jewish tragedies, and the Holocaust should be part of that. Okay, so there was a concession, and that's why we have a special day for the Holocaust. Fine. But you see the reticence to just add a special day, and here we got 32 of them. Why is Lag BaOmer a day of celebration? Next, skip two paragraphs. If all that happened in Lag BaOmer was but a temporary halt in the dying, wouldn't it be more fitting to set it aside as a memorial day for the 24,000 scholars who died? Now, what's the connection between Lag BaOmer and the revolt against the Romans? I want to speak about this revolt tonight. By Bar Kokhba and his army. And how does all this relate to Shimon Bar Yochai, the author of the mystical books of the Zohar? And finally, why are all these questions never talked about in the open? So you guys know that a little. As are, for example, the four questions of the Passover Seder. And by the way, this is like an enigma within the Orthodox world. You get 10 Orthodox Jews together, ask them about Lag BaOmer and this stuff. They got like a hazy notion. They just know they didn't have to go to school that day, or if they went to school, the rabbi took them out and they could play ball. That's what we used to do. We used to play ball with our teachers on Lag BaOmer. Right? We'd eat boxer tree. Remember? We'd eat like boxer from cheese. Also on Tu B'Av. Hated boxer. So the revolts.
Carob.
Carob. All right, whatever. But the answers to these questions he says, are really shrouded in the history and the mysteries, really, of the Jewish concept of the Mashiach. Before we delve into that, David.
Just a question. How about the 24,000? Were there anybody else who died from this affliction?
No. No, and that's what's very strange and interesting.
You can't just pass and say, oh, it was some, you know, going around at that time.
Now, the Talmud makes it very, very clear that all of a sudden, you know, started getting sick, and they all started dying, and they all stopped dying at a certain time. So it's pretty clear that there was something supernatural going on here. No one else was really affected. Only the greatest scholars of the generation. Just imagine that for a minute. How awful, but how also peculiar that would be.
Stop dying. If all 24,000 died,
who's left?
Yeah,
they were apparently left. How do we know that there were more left?
60 he found later.
Five, they found later, it says. But he had to travel to another part of Israel. It said he had to go to the north or the south.
So were there any left? It seems like there wouldn't be any left.
So some say that they were all finished off. Well, the Talmud says until the world was shamayim, was desolate. There was like no Torah scholars left. It was just Rabbi Akiva. Were you going to add anything on that?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I remember reading something. What about the possibility that they actually died in the Bar Kokhba rebellion?
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that. Oh, that it might have been edited. Editing is one thing. Completely changed is another. Because it makes it very clear that they died because of this stomach ailment. And they didn't necessarily fight, although it's connected to the Bar Kokhba revolt, which is what I want to get into. Kat?
If they died between the... During the time of the Omer, did they stop dying by Omer? Did they all die by the time of the Omer, or were they dying in the first 23 days?
It's unclear.
Did they continue dying until Shavuot?
They're different opinions. It's unclear. It's not 100.
There could have been some left.
There could have been some left, except the Talmud then says that the world was desolate, which implies that they were all gone. Or at least maybe the remaining that weren't gone, they were so sick. I don't know. I don't know if there's any real historical corroboration of this. This is a tradition passed down through the Talmud. It's a little hazy. Well, that's why we're permitted. We're not just celebrating on Lag BaOmer. After Lag BaOmer is over, we can then have weddings. We go back to our regular.
Except the people who don't.
Okay, but that's not because of that. That's just because they started late and therefore they want to keep a certain amount of time. I'm sorry I can't answer it more precisely, but essentially the way most people seem to read the Talmud is that they all stopped dying on the third, you know, by the 33rd day. And there was this period of time during which they all, you know, lost their lives, tragically. Let's talk a little about that as well. So let's understand that much of the material in the Talmud, take a look, that deals with political matters was written with a keen sensitivity to the Roman censor. The Talmud could not speak openly concerning the political ramifications of events. In fact, I was once studying with Rabbi Milner Zichron Alevracha at his home. He was a great scholar who lived in our community, Forest Hills, and I had the honor of learning with him for a couple of months. I went to his house each day, and I remember we were studying a Sanhedrin, the Gemara Sanhedrin, and it was about Jesus. And it was... The Gemara was about Mesis and Mediach, which is a whole someone who tries to lure people into a false Messiah. And there were certain things in my Gemara that didn't appear in his. And he corrected me, and I said, "What are you correcting me? It's here." And he was always correcting me, but hey. So he didn't believe me, and then I just took the Gemara and I said, "Rabbi, look." And he looked at it, and then he looked at his, and we had two different editions. He had the Vilna edition, he had this edition, one was censored and one wasn't, because it was about Jesus, which was censored probably for other reasons. So the Talmud could not speak openly concerning the political ramifications of events. In order to obtain a true picture of what happened, you really have to piece the story together from various historical sources and Talmudic hints. And what we discover goes something like this. The Second Temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE. Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside lay in ruins. From border to border, scores of thousands died in the fierce fighting, and subsequently from persecution and starvation. Thousands more were sold as slaves and forced into exile. The Romans considered the Jewish nation defeated, obliterated, and done for. The Roman general Titus is referred to as Titus Harasha in the evil Titus in the Talmud, and Titus we're familiar with, erected a grand victory monument in Rome, which stands to this day, that just says that, the famous Arch of Titus, where it says Judea Capita, Judea's kaput, finished, done for. And the best thing is, if you're there, anybody been to the Arch of Titus? So if you look, if you're standing here and you're looking at the arch, and you can see in the arch the menorah engraved with people carrying it away. If you look to your right, I don't know if they cleaned it up since then, but when I was there, some chutzpahdik Israeli wrote, spray painted on the wall, Am Yisrael Chai, the Jewish people is alive. You gotta love Israelis. So it's an amazing thing, Rabbi Shachtar. I went yesterday to the RCA conference. Yesterday, today was Wednesday, 2 days ago. Rabbinical Council of America. So Rabbi Shachter, who was the rabbi here for many years at the Jewish Center, was giving some lectures on intellectual Jewish history, and he talked about the burning of the Talmud in Paris, which took place in 1292. And he was discussing the whole thing. He was discussing the Maharam of Wittenberg, who was one of the Balei HaTosvos who was there at the burning of the Talmud in Paris. And he said that he came with a group of American Jews, and we got to the exact spot where historians believe that the Talmud was burnt publicly in some French name in the square in Paris. He just yelled out, Am Yisrael Chai, and they started dancing and singing in the middle of lunchtime downtown Paris where the Talmud was burnt. And it's an unbelievable thing. I mean, unfortunately, we could probably go to almost every country in Western, probably Eastern Europe also. Where we're still around, and unfortunate things like this happened. But even in defeat, let's get back to the Roman period, the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people struggled to rebuild Jewish life and recreate Jewish institutions. They were so successful, now this is after technically the Jews have been put down, the temple is destroyed. Around 135 CE, a Jewish military leader named Bar Kosiba succeeded in organizing a fighting force to rid the land of Israel of the hated Romans. Thousands rallied to his cause, including the greatest Talmudic scholar of all times, the Tana, Rabbi Akiva ben Yosef, whose insights and brilliant decisions fill the Mishnah. Anybody know, by the way, it says his name was Bar Kosiba, that was his actual name. How is he referred to? It was Bar Kochba. Who changed his name? So according to tradition, it was actually Rabbi Akiva that changed his name, because Kochba is Kochav, is star. From a verse from the Torah that it's an allusion to the coming of the Mashiach, Rabbi Akiva believed that Bar Kosiba was the Messiah. He was so successful, and therefore he renamed him Bar Kochba. Okay, we're going to get back to it. Many of Rabbi Akiva's contemporaries felt that a new revolt against the Romans was doomed to failure and urged the avoidance of bloodshed. But Bar Kosiba persisted and was successful in organizing and training a superb military force of 200,000 men. This is well documented. Talmud relates that Bar Kosiba demanded, you guys been to Masada, right? So Masada was also one of these last holdouts against the Romans. Okay, this is the period of time we're discussing. Talmud relates that Bar Kosiba demanded each recruit demonstrate his bravery by cutting off a finger. The rabbis protested. He substituted a new test. They were expected to uproot a young tree while riding a horse. Such was the level of their bravery and readiness. Rabbi Akiva disagreed with his rabbinic colleagues and won over a majority to his point of view. From the military point of view, he felt that a successful revolt was feasible. It is said by some historians that 20% of the population of the Roman Empire between Rome and Jerusalem was Jewish. Pagan foundations of Rome were crumbling. Many Romans were in search of a religious alternative, which many of them subsequently found in a mitzvah-less Christianity in the following two centuries. Many Romans were attracted to Judaism and significant numbers converted. There were actually thousands, tens of thousands of sympathizers. Some members of the Roman Senate actually converted to Judaism. If the large numbers of Jews who lived throughout the Roman Empire could be inspired into coordinated anti-Roman revolts, many historians believe that the prospects for toppling Rome were very real. Now, Rabbi Akiva very much believed, and he looked at the world through the prism of Torah, and he believed that this could bring about the Messianic Age. Because what was the Messianic Age about? It's about bringing the oneness of God to all of humanity. Rome was the superpower in the world. To give you a little sense how powerful Rome was, take the United States, which I guess today is considered, even this during this terrible economy, a world superpower. Rome was without a question considered much more of an uncontested superpower than the United States is today. It was incredibly mighty and powerful, but there were serious issues, and the Jews were at the center of it. And Rabbi Akiva believed that they could bring about the Mashiach, spirituality, universal peace, foretold by the Jewish prophets, the great millennia during which all Jews would return to the land of Israel, the temple could be rebuilt, and Israel would lead the world into an era of justice, spiritual revival and fulfillment. Now he quotes the Rambam, because Maimonides writes that Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kokhba was actually the Mashiach. In the Laws of Kings, Maimonides, in discussing the Messianic era, says, "Do not think that the King Mashiach must work miracles and signs, create new natural phenomena, restore the dead to life, or perform similar miracles. This is not so, because Rabbi Akiva was the wisest of scholars of the Mishnah, and was the armor-bearer of Bar Kokhba," the actual family name of Bar Kokhba, the king. "He said concerning Bar Kokhba that he's the King Mashiach. Both he and the sages of his generation believed that Bar Kokhba was the King Mashiach until he was killed because of his sins. Once he was killed, it became evident to them that he was not the Messiah." Now that sounds simple, but that actually is used as a source when having conversations or debates with some Lubavitch Hasidim that believe that the Rebbe, even though he's no longer alive, could still somehow be the Mashiach. This is cited as you could have believed, perhaps, that the Rebbe, while he was alive, was the Mashiach, or was going to be developed into the Mashiach. He has some of the criteria, actually, reinforcing the breaches of Torah in Israel. If any one human being, one Jew, did this in a generation, it could be argued it was the late Lubavitch Rebbe, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, but once he died, that belief is laid to rest. To Bar Kokhba and his officers, all seemed to be in readiness. Rome was rotten and corrupt. Many captive nations strained at the yoke. Rebellion was in the air. Rabbi Akiva gave Bar Kokhba a new name, I mentioned. He proclaimed Bar Kokhba was a long-awaited Messiah. Second paragraph. One of the greatest Torah teachers and leaders of all time, Rabbi Akiva could not have made this crucial and radical declaration until he was certain. He would never have proclaimed the man Messiah unless he knew. Now, of course, he was mistaken, but he would not have done this, says Rabbi Stolper, unless he believed it with all of his heart and soul. Rabbi Akiva added a new spiritual dimension to the war of liberation. He attempted to merge the soldiers of the sword with the soldiers of the book. His 24,000 students, each a great Torah scholar and leader. These scholars would become the real army, spiritual and moral force that would bring Torah to the entire world, overcoming anguish, suffering, and the cruel boot of the corrupt Roman Empire. They would soon inaugurate a new era of peace, righteousness, and justice, an era in which, quote, "the knowledge of God would cover the earth as water covers the seas," which is a reference to the way the world is supposed to be in the Messianic Age. The fact that the Jews were able to unite around a single leader separates this event from the great revolt of the previous century, when bitterly divided factions warred with each other inside the walls of Jerusalem, even as the Roman army stormed the gates. What happened? The rebellion lasted for 6 years. Think about that for a minute. That's unbelievable. You know, they said the same thing with the Warsaw Uprising against the Nazis. It lasted 6 weeks. Poland fell to the Nazis in 6 days. This rebellion raged for 6 years. Bar Kokhba's army achieved many initial victories. Many non-Jews joined his army. It's reported that it grew to 350,000 men, more men than the Roman army. Bar Kokhba was so successful that Hadrian was a terrible, cruel tyrant. He was an emperor of Rome that, according to tradition, put to death the 10 martyrs. We recite this. Rabbi Akiva was one of them. We recite this on both Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av about Hadrian. And he called in all of his best troops from England and Gaul. Rome felt threatened. Lag Ba'omer is the day believed by some that Bar Kokhba's army reconquered Yerushalayim. We celebrate the great event today. For 4 years, Jewish independence was restored. Many believe that Bar Kokhba actually began to rebuild the temple. Some even believe he completed building the third temple. Now this is very, very important, because this whole issue of the Mashiach gives this whole Bar Kokhba revolt a new added dimension. And I remember years ago I heard, I don't know if I shared this with you, I was at an Israel Bonds breakfast. And I heard my rabbi of our synagogue, Rabbi Grimblatt, invoke this as an ancient parallel to something that happened in our own generation. Can you see the parallel? What's the parallel in our own generation? Here you have Rabbi Akiva, great rabbinic sage, thousands of his talmidim, of his students. There's this very successful military revolt against the Romans, and there is an attempt to what? To bring it all together. What's the parallel today? You see a parallel?
Israel.
What's the parallel? So who were really the initial Zionist pioneers? They were not rabbis with flowing white beards. They were not rabbinic scholars or yeshiva students. Although there were some religious Jews that fought in 1948 and 67, of course, and there are many more today. But it was essentially a secular nationalistic movement. Zionism, if you study the writings of Theodor Herzl and even more contemporaries like Ben-Gurion and the like, it's very little to do with Torah per se, unfortunately. But the question is, what is the reaction by the rest of the Torah community? Do we look at it and say, well, they're not interested in really using Israel as a way of returning Jews to Zion and to Torah? But what is it? Rabbi Akiva, I don't know what he saw in Bar Kokhba exactly. There's actually a fascinating debate. Was Bar Kokhba even a religious personality? So I actually did a little research on this. Two Jews, three opinions. I spoke with one rabbi who got very upset with me that I even implied, that was Rav Nevensol, that he wasn't religious. And this is back that he certainly was. And I spoke with Dr. Berger, who was a historian of the Yeshiva University, and they have some documentation that is attributed to that time period of a shipment, of an ordering of a shipment of lulavim and etrogim, a large order for lulavim and etrogim. It's some sort of document that they have dated to that time period, and some scholars believe that this was Bar Kokhba's ordering of lulavim and etrogim around the holiday of Sukkot for his army, which would seem to indicate he was a religious personality. That's not usually what a general gets for his army. I don't know how much unless they thought the etrogim were grenades and the lulavim were bayonets.
Also, asking to chop off a pinky out of loyalty.
What was that? Right. And then you have a statement like that, and when I'd spoken with Rabbi Grimblatt, he also didn't seem to, he doesn't necessarily believe that he was a religious personality. There are statements made by Bar Kokhba that seem to imply that not only was he not religiously observant, but he was almost kind of saying, I'm doing this on my own, I don't need God. And that he was like, and you'll see what happened a little later. So it's unclear, but it doesn't matter. The point is, Rabbi Akiva still believed that he could be the Mashiach. Now, there were two Roman legions in the country when the uprising began, one in Jerusalem and one near Megiddo. Both were decimated by Bar Kokhba's men. Reinforcements were dispatched from Transjordan, Syria, and Egypt, but they too were mauled. The legion sent from Egypt, 22nd, disappeared from the listings of military units published in Rome, and some scholars speculate that it was cut up so badly, probably around Lachish, that it ceased to exist as an organized force. The Jews apparently employed guerrilla tactics, foraying from their underground lairs, ambushing convoys, striking at night. In desperation, Hadrian sends for his best commander, who was then engaged in battle somewhere else. This guy imports legions from Britain, Switzerland, Austria, Hungary, and Bulgaria. So badly had the Romans been hurt in the bruising campaign that Severus, upon returning to Rome to report to the Senate on the success, omitted the customary formula, "I and my army are well." They were really getting at the Romans. This was total war. In the middle of the effort to rebuild the temple, the tide turned, and Bar Kokhba lost the support of Rabbi Akiva. He lost his support. And the Chacham and the sages who backed him, why? Bar Kokhba murdered Rabbi Eliezer. was a great Torah sage. He accused the great rabbi of revealing the secret entrances of the fortress city of Beitar. Beitar was the last stronghold. It was the last holdout against the Romans. And Bar Kokhba believed, for whatever reason, that this Rabbi Elazar revealed the entrances to this fortress city, to the Romans. It is now believed that this betrayal was the work of the Jewish Christians who wanted to undermine Bar Kokhba. Rabbi Akiva then realized that Bar Kokhba no longer possessed the qualities which initially led him to believe he was Mashiach, that if he could take the life of a rabbinic colleague that was a Yusnan, could not be the Mashiach, that he was mistaken. Well, it's very interesting. In order to be a Christian initially, you have to be a Jew who believed that Jesus was the Messiah, which is very fascinating. Christians, certainly during the time of Jesus and even shortly thereafter, Christian meant you were a Jew. And if you weren't a Jew, you had to convert to Judaism and then believe that Jesus was the Mashiach. Which is why, by the way, how do you convert to Judaism? Three things for a man, two things for a woman. Immersion in a mikvah, acceptance of the mitzvot, and for a man, circumcision. When Christianity wanted to popularize Christianity, okay, and accepting all 613 was just too difficult if you really wanted to popularize it to the extent that they wanted to, so they dropped the 613 in favor of the Big Ten, the Ten Commandments, which is why, by the way, many prayer books used to have the Ten Commandments in the beginning, and when the church popularized the Ten Commandments, the rabbis pulled it out of the Siddur. Because they didn't want people thinking what Christians were being led to believe, which is that the Ten Commandments are any more important than the other 603.
What about Christians?
Doesn't matter. The other thing where they did was they supplanted the whole observance with faith. That was not necessarily during Jesus' time. That was thereafter. Because Jesus himself, they said, if Jesus was alive today, the only place he'd probably feel comfortable davening is in an Orthodox synagogue. Okay, and that's probably true. What's interesting today is if you want to be a Christian, what do you have to do today?
Baptism.
You have to be baptized. The only thing they held on to was the immersion in the mikvah, which is baptism. Mm. Where do you think it came from? Okay? They dropped the acceptance of the mitzvot and they dropped circumcision. It simply did not sell to the masses. Okay? Judaism is not a proselytizing religion. We don't go out and try to get everybody to be Jewish. So it's all about the authenticity, not necessarily the numbers. So it's a very, very important point. So that's what it means to Jewish Christians. All Christians initially were Jews. Jesus was Jewish. They were all nice Jewish boys. Religious Jewish boys. Okay? So all of them. And quite knowledgeable as well. The only thing was, he believed, and Jesus never claimed he was a god, he had any kind of divine, but he believed he was the Mashiach. And that, you know, sort of led to the next thing.
So you spoke about the Judaism being not a proselytizing religion, so it's actually in response to the rebellion that there were different periods in time.
Right.
Sometimes they did it, sometimes they didn't.
Right. It seems during this period, during the actual Roman period, that there was a bit of a push towards proselytization because, there were Roman senators open to Judaism. Yeah.
Back to this about Rabbi Elazar.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Is this when the Passover Seder when we talk about Rabbi Akiva?
No. This is Rabbi Elazar as opposed to Eliezer.
Oh.
Eliezer is in the. But Rabbi Elazar was an incredible rabbinic sage in his own right. Right. Now these are the same personalities though, Rabbi Akiva. Well, the truth is it could be. Was it Elazar? Who's in the Haggadah? It's Elazar. That's him. Yeah.
He was one of them.
Yeah, I think that's him. Excuse me. Thank you.
But also the paragraph after Ein Kelo Heinu.
Yeah, it might be him too. There are a number of Eliezer's, Elazar's in the Talmud.
He was sitting in the tunnels in the caves, that's why.
Talking about why they didn't know it was time to say the Shema. That's what's so fascinating about discussing them, because they were talking about the Exodus and look what they were going through.
Yeah.
Look what they were living through. Now, there's an additional spiritual dimension to the failure of the Messiahship of Bar Kokhba as well. Whether the spiritual failure of Rabbi Akiva's students was the cause, that's what Rabbi Grimblatt suggests in his book. That because the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva couldn't get it together themselves, what was the reason they all died? disrespect one for the next, that they were unable to really inspire Jews outside of their own group. Maybe we'll come back to that. But whether it was the failure of Bar Kokhba to rise to the spiritual heights expected of the Messiah is beyond our knowledge. We don't really know. Why did this whole thing collapse? It could be because Bar Kokhba did not merit this, because the way he behaved. Or it could be because the students of Rabbi Akiva didn't do what they needed to do in order to properly inspire the rest of the community. For then, out of the blue, the great plague Askara descended and struck. The dream collapsed. For reasons that will probably remain forever obscure, the students of Rabbi Akiva were not considered by heaven to have reached the supreme spiritual heights necessary to bring about the Messianic age. As great as they were, an important factor was missing. What was it? The Talmud tells us they didn't show respect for each other. Precisely what this phrase refers to, we do not know. With greatness comes heightened responsibility. With greatness comes a magnification of reward and punishment. Who else do we have an example of this in the Torah?
Miriam.
Okay, give me a better example even. Oh, that's pretty good. Never heard that. Moshe. Moshe, instead of speaking to the rock to get water, hits the rock, and God says he can't come into Israel. How is that fair? How does the punishment fit the crime? The classic answer is, for Moshe Rabbeinu, on the spiritual level that he was, the slightest deviation from God's word is considered so egregious, it's so difficult that it would warrant such a difference. I mean, even if you don't get it, that means because we're operating from our perspective, so we're projecting, how could that be? But if you have someone who's on his level, and that's why I'm always concerned with talking about the students of Rabbi Akiva, and they all died, they didn't show respect, causes us to think, oh, the rabbis didn't have respect. They didn't. They were missing. But it was on their level that they didn't have respect. You know, in concert with their level of spiritual connectedness and religious piety, they were missing. They weren't on the level that they needed to be vis-a-vis their fellow man. But it didn't mean they're walking around like boors to each other, completely disrespectful to each other. It means that they didn't respect each other on the level that was expected of such great righteous scholars. For their failure and deficiencies, which would certainly be counted as minor in a generation such as ours, but which were crucial for great men on their high spiritual level, their mission was canceled. And they died a mysterious death. And with them died the messianic hope of that era. That's why we make such a big deal about Lag BaOmer. That's why we make such a big deal about this whole thing. Because it's not just the death of... I don't want to say just, because it was 24,000. But it wasn't just their death. What else died with them? This whole dream that Rabbi Akiva had, that the Bar Kokhba revolt would bring with it messianic redemption. Bar Kokhba was not a false messiah, but a failed messiah. In the terrible war which followed, Bar Kokhba and his army were destroyed in the great battles defending the fortress city of Beitar. The war had been a catastrophe. Dodio Cassius reports the death of 580,000 Jews by Roman swords, in addition to those who died of hunger and disease. I mean, you know what that is? How many Jews lived in the world at that time? Some scholars think that the bulk of the Jewish population of Judea was destroyed in battle and in subsequent massacres. One historian believes that Jews lost a third of their number in the war, perhaps more fatalities than the great revolt of the year 70. For the survivors, the Bar Kokhba uprising marked the great divide between the hope for national independence and dispersal in the diaspora. The trauma of Beitar coming after the fall of Jerusalem affected deep changes in the Jewish people. The stiff-necked, stubborn, fanatically independent people that did not hesitate to make repeated suicidal lunges at the mightiest superpower of antiquity lost its warlike instincts. It'd be 2,000 years before there would be a Jewish fighting force. This is so interesting because we are products, I think, of the last 2,000 years. The mentality and the perception of the Jew as a victim still prevails in the world. The modern world cannot handle Israel, in my opinion, because the world has grown so accustomed to seeing the Jew as a victim, and cannot handle the Jew as a strong fighting force. And I think that's important to remember, because we think we were always like that until the State of Israel was created in 1948. But we weren't. That's what diaspora, that's what exile did to us. But that wasn't our natural state when we were in Israel. We almost took out the Roman Empire. As a result, the hope of the Jew for redemption was to be delayed for at least 2,000 years. In the great and tragic defeat, not only were between 500,000 to 600,000 Jews killed, but the Romans were determined once and for all to uproot the Jewish religion and the Jewish people, to bring an end to their hopes and their dreams. And that's why we mourn today. Last paragraph. The mourning of Sfira is not for the students alone. It's for the failure also of the Jewish people to bring about the Messianic age, for the fall of the curtain on Jewish independence, Jewish hopes, and Jewish Messianic ambitions. Every anti-Semitic outbreak for which Jews suffered since that day, every pogrom, massacre, crusade, and Holocaust that took the toll of so many millions during the 2,000-year-long and bitter night of exile, must be traced directly to the failure of Bar Kokhba, and ultimately to the failure of the students of Rabbi Akiva. This was a tragedy of intestinal proportions to a war-ravaged world suffering under the bitter yoke of Rome as well as to the Jewish people. Rome did not fall at that time, but its fury and rage led to the exile and dismemberment of the Jewish people. Now, by the end of the class here, we'd all walk out crying. Something else though positive happened, which is also why it's a day, which is why it's a day of celebration. What happened on Lag BaOmer? In the midst of the defeat, a great sage, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, revealed to a small number of students the secrets of the mystical Zohar. In the Zohar and its formulas, disciplines, and spirituality lie the secrets whose seed will bring about the coming of the Messiah. The Zohar's living tradition has kept hope alive down to this very day. In Lag BaOmer, the plague stopped, the dream was delayed, but it was not destroyed. It was to be nurtured through the generations. See, what Lag BaOmer said was that it's not completely over. And that's really picked up in the Talmud after Rabbi Akiva loses everything. And what does he do? He starts traveling around looking for more students. He finds 5 more students, and the Gemara says, V'heim heim imidu talmidim. And from them, they reestablish more and more scholars. Rabbi Akiva was able to, and it's amazing, I was discussing this with Rabbi Krug, some of you were on our Shabbaton in Teaneck, Rabbi Johnny Krug was there. He said almost every passage in the Talmud where Rabbi Akiva appears, he's laughing. And he's always laughing in the face of ridiculous adversity. He's walking around at the site of the temple, and foxes are walking around, and his colleagues are crying, and he's standing there laughing. And they come over him and say, how could you laugh? It's the Chorban. It's the destruction. Our temple lays in ruins. And then he found a verse somewhere in Tanakh that said that if that prophecy, that the temple would be destroyed, was fulfilled, then there's another prophecy with another verse that says it's going to be rebuilt and the Messiah will one day be returned. Rabbi Akiva was the ultimate optimist. And he actually started out that way. Because we all know the most famous story of Rabbi Akiva. He's the hero of the Baal Tshuva movement, because Rabbi Akiva was 40 years old when he started learning about Judaism. He went to study with 5-year-olds. He was an illiterate shepherd. You got to be a pretty big optimist and to believe in yourself when you go to a school and you're 40 and you're sitting in a classroom with 5-year-olds to be able to learn the alphabet. And then the Talmud tells these other incredible stories about Rabbi Akiva, how he went off for years. The other lesson is that you need someone to support you. I don't mean just financially. I mean spiritually and emotionally. He had an incredibly supportive wife who believed in him. He married actually the daughter of a great scholar, and they were against the shidduch because he didn't know anything. And he ended up making himself into such a great scholar that the Medrash says, it's in the Talmud, that when Moshe Rabbeinu found out about Rabbi Akiva, that there would one day be a scholar, Rabbi Akiva, he asked God why God foolishly chose to give the Torah through him and not Rabbi Akiva. He didn't say foolishly, but the way it's mentioned is like, you know, why would you do that through me? That's if you got him. Started at 40, and he was the leader. And the whole movement failed. It was a terrible catastrophe, but it didn't end. And that's Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer starts up again. And that's why it's a great day of celebration. There are frightening parallels between our own age and an age of Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kokhba. Following a frightful Holocaust, which many believe would spell the end of the Jewish people, we experienced the restoration of Jewish independence. Once more did the Jewish army score miraculous victories against overwhelming odds. Following destruction of the great European centers of Torah scholarship, we witnessed the rebuilding of yeshivot in America and in Israel. We experienced a great revival of Torah study. The Tshuva movement has brought about a return to Torah for so many who strayed. Jerusalem and the Temple Mount are in our hands. And you could say, you can get a little cynical, yeah, we got all sorts of problems and issues. You know, that's caving in to what you read about Israel in the media, because that's the only thing the media picks up on. Every day you see Israel in a paper, we should make a bracha that it exists. That should be a cause for celebration every day, not just on Yom HaTzma'ot. You think about that, because we only seem to point out the negative. All around us, world empires are tottering while despair and corruption rages. Once again, the Jewish people has been entrusted with a great and frightful opportunity. Once again, we have been given the potential to recreate a Jewish civilization of Torah greatness in our own land. Will we succeed, or will our efforts be aborted because of our own failures, our own inability to respect the differences within the Torah community and unite the Jewish people to our cause? The personality of Rabbi Akiva itself offers frightful lessons and opportunities. It was Rabbi Akiva who understood that love your fellow as you love yourself is the overriding principle which the Torah people must internalize if it is to achieve its goals. Rabbi Akiva too is the quintessential Baal Tshuva. It was he who was 40 years old and was unable to distinguish between an Aleph and a Bet. It was he who rose to be Jewry's greatest Torah scholar. Hundreds of thousands of Jews, Americans, Israelis, Russians are today's potential Rabbi Akivas. The fate of Jewry and the achievement of heaven's greatest goals are in the hands of this generation. Will we attempt to achieve them, or will we withdraw into our own selfish cocoons by refusing to shoulder the responsibilities which history and history's God has set before us? It is not enough to wait for the Mashiach's coming. We must toil to perfect our Torah lives if we are to bring about his speedy arrival. Only if we learn from the lesson of Rabbi Akiva's students will we understand that the coming of the Mashiach depends on us. Questions?
So before
is that a great article? It's unbelievable. Yeah. You should Google his name. He's got a lot of amazing stuff. Sorry.
Isn't it that, in fact, Jesus was the Messiah, or he thought he was the Messiah?
Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. He never thought he was the Mashiach?
Not him. When,
did Bar Kokhba think he was the Mashiach?
People thought Jesus was the Mashiach, right?
During the time?
It wasn't exactly during this time. It was during the Roman period.
So, what's the difference if we're looking, like, okay, we're waiting for the Mashiach, but what does that mean if, I don't get it. If we're waiting, are we waiting for a person? If it is a person, then is it the same thing?
The Talmud says that the person always exists, actually. It just needs to, will only reveal itself to a generation that is worthy of it.
So
it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if the Mashiach exists but is hiding or waiting around for us to be ready. That means that we have to recognize a movement as having the potential. That's what he's trying to say. That we have to recognize that there could be a potentiality for the Messianic redemption. And if we see the potential, then we got to get behind it and do what we can to make it happen. That's what Rabbi Akiva was trying to do. It failed. He tried, it failed, and it failed because the students either didn't get their act together or Bar Kokhba himself was a failed leader. Whatever the reason was, it failed. Question is, he's saying that we might be presented with the same opportunity today. And in fact, those of you who were here for my class on religious Zionism, we studied what is Rav Kook's approach to religious Zionism. What is Rav Kook's approach to religious Zionism? We said there were two ways of looking at religious Zionism. One is the Rav Soloveitchik approach, and the other was Rav Kook's approach. Not the three ways, not the anti-neutral, the pros, the people who are in favor, who believe that it has religious significance. There are two ways of looking at it. What was the Rav Kook approach? Anybody remember? Think for a moment. These are all pro. Pro. We're not doing anti, we're not doing neutral. We're doing the pro. What's that? No, that's the neutral approach.
It's the beginning.
That it's the beginning of the Messianic redemption. Right. Right. And that's what we say every Shabbat in our prayers. Reshit Smichat Geulatenu. That Israel is the beginning of the sprouting of our redemption. That's what many religious Zionists believe today. So applying that to this,
right,
it would be to get behind Israel and do what we can to make Israel into not simply another nation state in the world, but a messianic reality.
How is it different in the Christian world then if they thought that Jesus was the Messiah? Like, how is it different?
We hopefully believe we're right.
And they believe they're right.
That's correct.
And that's the difference between us and them?
The difference is who is right.
And you understand?
Well, of course, that is always it. I mean,
listen, we don't necessarily subscribe to the same, you know, truth. One, by definition, one has to be false. There can only be one Mashiach. Okay, there have been many false messiahs. Jesus was just the most popular. I studied this week about Shabtai Tzvi, who other great rabbis thought was a Mashiach and caused much worse, or at least as bad, havoc and problems in the Jewish community. We have to be careful before pointing the finger at someone and saying, you know, they are the Mashiach. You have to have but Rabbi Akiva believe that he was. And today, nobody claims that Ben-Gurion was a Mashiach, but there are great rabbis today who believe that Ben-Gurion and the secular Zionists are ushering in a phenomena, a movement that could, if we get behind it, morph into the messianic redemption. Don't think of it as some sort of like, one night you're going to wake up and the Mashiach is here. That's the way we all grew up thinking about the Mashiach. When is it going to come? I'm waiting. It's brought. Mashiach doesn't come. It's brought.
Isn't one of the distinctions, especially most notably with Jesus and Shabtai Tzvi, that they tried to nullify the mitzvahs? I mean, especially Shabtai Tzvi, his basic, just like Shabtai Tzvi's philosophy in a nutshell, was that God knew everything, and since God was inherently good, anything that you do, he knows you're going to do it, and since he knows everything is unfairly good, so whether I eat kosher food or I eat pork, it's still a mitzvah because it's what God wants you to do. So Shabtai Tzvi basically attempted to nullify all the mitzvahs, which also Jesus tried to do, which is a clear sign of non-mashiach, is my understanding.
That's a pretty good depiction. One of the things that Maimonides says is a requirement for the criteria to be the Mashiach is that it is someone who is Hoga B'Torah B'Mitzvahs K'David Aviv, he says, someone who's infused with Torah and Mitzvahs like David, his ancestor, and he's able to reinforce the breaches of Torah observance. So once someone starts preaching things that are not in the Torah, or against the Torah, or let's say non-observance, then you know you're not dealing with the right, you know, with the right. But just because someone has that too doesn't necessarily make him a Mashiach either. It's a very complicated. It's very, very complicated. Now, how do you really know someone's a Mashiach? The Rambam writes. So if he's got all those things, then he has a chazakah, he has a presumptive status of being the Messiah, but only after he brings all the Jews to Israel, rebuilds the Third Temple, and effects universal peace and brotherhood, can you really know that that person is actually the Mashiach. But that ain't going to happen with one individual. It's going to happen because there's been a sort of an enlightenment in the world, ideally through the Jewish people. That's our role, is to try to bring the Mashiach, absolutely. That's why we believe every mitzvah that we perform, every Torah, every class that we come to, we're bringing ourselves closer to that because we're bringing the Torah into more of the world. And the more we do that, the more we can usher in the Messianic redemption. But it's a process. It's a process. It's not something that simply happens overnight. Any other questions or comments about any of this Lag BaOmer stuff? Yeah.
I was going to say that Rabbi Kaplan
said
that Paul was the Messiah.
That's great.
So it's written why Jesus wasn't the Messiah. And also at the end of it, he has a discussion talking about what you said about how the Messiah, the Messianic age, would move out.
Kat, thank you. It's called The Real Messiah. It's one of those little paperback jobs on the shelf. Yeah.
So back to this for 1 second. So I'm just looking at what part you read on like page 4, I guess. It said that when we were winning against the Romans, and they called in troops from Transjordan, Syria, and Egypt, and then we kind of outnumbered them at that time. Isn't that like 1967?
Right. It's interesting. I mean, I don't know if they
probably weren't called those things back then. He's just giving us, like, you know, geographical areas, what we refer to them today. He did the same thing with certain European countries that didn't exist during the Roman era. But that's actually very interesting. The parallels are quite striking. You know, and to just look at them and blow them off, I think, is to stare. I wouldn't say it's obvious, but it's. Another parallel.
Where is it reported that
about Rabbi Elazar? You know what? His sources for a lot of this are taken from secular historical sources. He doesn't quote. He doesn't quote them. I do know some of the sources are from the Talmud, but he says the whole story is not really told in the Talmud because of the censors. So I don't really know. I have heard that it is something that was pretty well documented. If you say the word bar kochba to a rabbi, there's always like a little negative. You know, the rabbis never had such a positive feeling for bar kochba. But it's not so different than the same reaction that a contemporary rabbi might have to to some secular Zionistic leaders who came out very, you know, we did this, this was us, and, you know, God has nothing to do with this. This is, we want to be a country like any other country. It's not so different. And just like then, you had a religious community then, you have a religious community today. The question is, can we get it all together? That is the question. Closest thing, by the way, that it was the Mashiach, he points out, is that so many Jews rallied behind Bar Kochba. So many Jews rallied behind him, and religious Jews rallied behind him because of Rabbi Akiva.
It just goes to show that you never know until.
You're never going to know.
Seeds or fails.
The proof is in the pudding, as they say.
Of Torah.
Exactly. Very good point.
That it was him.
And right. And was mistaken.
Hundreds of thousands of Jews rallied.
Right.
Right. And it wasn't that he was, assuming that what this says is true, it wasn't right. Mistaken. It's just it was a failed attempt. So.
It could have been.
So probably. Was,
you know what's the same thing? Everyone, we have these very magical, these magical, mystical notions about everything. Concept of Bashar. So, oh, it's not my Bashar. Could have been your Bashar, possibly. Now we have this idea that there's a passage in the Talmud that a bat kol goes out 40 days before you're born. Da, da, da. Well, it wasn't so that you make your own besher. I believe that. Okay, now it has to be within a certain individual, and has to be you have to have certain other things. But it's the same idea with the Mashiach. It's not as though it wasn't meant. It could have been the Mashiach if we made him into the Mashiach. Part of the Mashiach is supposed to be us. That's the fundamental disagreement between the Satmar that we discussed, the anti-religious Zionist view, that says we have to wait here until God put us in exile and he's going to take us out, and we're not supposed to have anything to do with our own redemption. That's the fundamental disagreement. The religious Zionists believe, and that's Rav Salvechik's article called Fate and Destiny, that we are supposed to not be a people of fate, but a people of destiny. We're supposed to take our destiny in our own hands. And we're supposed to bring the Mashiach and not simply wait around for it. Okay, and that's what Rabbi Akiva was trying to do. All you can do is try. Can't guarantee success. Yeah, Joseph.
So, if you look at the time of Jesus and you believe that Jesus is the Messiah,
right.
And then you
Well, you might have continued to believe he was.
Okay, but
it's a lot of them continued. That's what bolstered the.
Right.
You do tshuva. You do tshuva. You come back to the Jewish people. You can. There isn't any sin in the Torah from which a Jew cannot come back. So, and you know, they were. I'm sure. Well, if it was sincere, no, it could have been a mistake. Could have been a terrible mistake. It could have been a mistake. But if the rabbis are coming out while he's preaching and saying he's not the right one, because let's say Ben said before that he was preaching things that were not consistent with Torah.
Okay,
and the rabbis say he can't be the Mashiach, but I still believe he is. He's very charismatic and he's getting people to be, he's doing all these wonderful things. So that might be sinful then, because you're just basically saying, I don't care what the rabbis say, I think he's the Mashiach. But if there's a real basis to believe this, what about all the Jews that thought that Bar Kochba was the Mashiach and their hopes were smashed? Listen, what about all the Lubavitchers who believed?
that the Rebbe was the Mashiach, and when he died, I mean, this is my personal view, that for some it's not a theological, it's a psychological reality, that he loomed so large for so many of his followers they couldn't accept the fact that he was no longer alive, and therefore you come up with some sort of, you know, I think.
But you have to do tshuva for that.
If it flies in the face of what Jewish tradition or the rabbis are teaching, perhaps. But if Rabbi Akiva thought he was the Mashiach, then you follow your teachings of the rabbi and it makes sense to you, then what are you doing tshuva for?
Right.
You're just doing what you're supposed to do as a Jew. It's a little complicated. It's a belief, though. I don't know if you do tshuva for beliefs. Tshuva is really for activities and behaviors.
Isn't that like a mistake in philosophy, though, to begin with? I mean, the whole thing is that, at least from Rabbi was saying with from the Rambam, so you have to have proofs for things, right? So he looks at it from a very rational standpoint. If you have this and you have this and you have this and you have this, so you're golden. If you don't, so then you're not.
Right, but even that's what.
No, so there should be very.
No, that's what Daniel was just saying a minute ago, that you don't really know, even the Rambam, no one can really know if the Mashiach's Mashiach until they do all those other things. And then it's going to be very clear to everybody.
What I'm saying is, it should be very cerebral, right?
Yeah, but it can't be because because I'm not saying anyone can do those things, but there have been individuals who have done some of those things and look like they're. And you put enough desire in there because life is so miserable, and you put it all together, you can make a good case that maybe this is a Mashiach.
Right, but I was just saying that, like, when a person dies and you're still holding, you know, and you're still holding on to something, so I'm saying that might be like a mistaken philosophy, because that you see, you know, after the fact, you see maybe that your philosophy was flawed to begin with because you weren't looking at it from an objective standpoint.
Maybe.
You put your own ideas.
They have. I mean, I haven't done enough work on this, but I spoke with one Lubavitcher who said, no, there is some source somewhere, I never checked it out, that says that the Mashiach could still be the Mashiach even if he's no longer alive.
Yeah, but then why would it be the Mashiach himself? Like,
I don't know, but it's not a source that I don't think is considered like, you know, there are a lot of things said in the Talmud. We don't follow everything that's said in the Talmud. There are a lot of conflicting opinions. All right, we're going to close it up here. I want to wish you all. When is Lag BaOmer, by the way?
Monday night,
Tuesday. So everybody is required to build their own bonfire, preferably at work. Just kidding. So Monday night, Tuesday. Just so you know, this coming Shabbat, we have four namings. Not of little kids either. Four MJE participants that are receiving their Hebrew name for the first time this Shabbat. And we also have the rabbi that spoke to some of you guys, Rabbi Avi Heller, is going to be coming and speaking again a little. I'll be speaking as well. He'll be speaking. And the following Shabbat, I just want to mention Rabbi Sinhali Pavlov, who is the director of She'arim, is going to be coming as well. So a lot of good stuff going on. So I encourage you guys to come around on Shabbos. Have a great night and a wonderful Lag BaOmer when it hits. What is the... You know, we can do it right now. It's 9:15. Last night was...
Tonight is 28. I already counted, so it's fine.
So if you want to just... Right, we'll do it together. Baruch. If you haven't said the blessing, just answer Amen. And then you can say the night with me. Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam. Asher Kedushanu B'Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu Al Svirat HaOmer. Hayom Shmona V'Esrim Yom. Shehem Arba Shavuot BaOmer. Today is 28 days of Yomer that are 4 weeks. 4 weeks. 28. Be a great day, everyone. Good night. Take care, everyone. Oh, nice.
How's that for an app? There's an app for that.
Oh, yeah, my friend
brings
it
up every day.
That's really cool.
Oh, I get that. We just bought Yosef one of these jobs.
Yeah? Nice.
Download
it. It's free.
Yeah?
There's an app.
That's very cool.
Thanks.
Pleasure
to
have
you.
You're welcome anytime.
I might have to show you that other one.
My daughter.
Sweetie, you like Sophie. It was so good. You're awesome.
Her name is Leora Esther.
Oh, beautiful.
That is awesome.
I told you that. Like,
that's an iPhone drum.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're moving yet again.
Where are you moving?
To Boston. I got into Tufts for grad school. It'll be the third state that my wife and I live in less than 3 years of marriage.
Barely.
New York first, then New Jersey, and now Massachusetts.
That's you.
We're going to live in Brighton. It's right next door and apparently it's less expensive. And actually, I was told that Nicole always
said.
Buy a house and then an apartment.
Oh, yeah? How are you doing?
We're going, not this house, next time.
But
he's mostly in for now. I just feel like Brighton, I mean, first of all, I think it's the more affordable of the two,
I don't know.
No, I don't know at all. This is just from talking to people. They're like former guys. Right. I've heard of this also. So whatever. So we're going up there, and you know, we're going to see some places and this and that. And so that's the deal. Yeah, she was pretty good. Apparently there's a woman's shiur on like 70 something in West End that Alana wanted to go to. So they're there. I guess she gets Scar Felicha, I guess, something like that. I mean, technically I drove, but maybe that counts.
How are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good.
I have a question. I might have talked to you more at length about it. So, my Hebrew name, as I'm like getting more involved with classes and stuff, I don't know whether or not I have one, because there's a story floating around in my family that my grandparents gave us all Hebrew names in secrecy. No, that's not it.
Your reference mark.
My mother married an Andre, and so I don't know if my grandparents ever knew that we were baptized, but they knew that we weren't getting these names. And so the story was that they gave us this secrecy. But my mother tried calling the synagogue, and I'm like, well, we don't have
that. You never had a naming ceremony.
Could my grandparents have ever given me a Hebrew name? And like, without me, without being there?
Physically need to go write this up. Send the email to him so that way the two of us can discuss it.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry for interrupting, but you weren't talking so long. A kind of similar situation happened with my wife.
Yeah. I need a little research on that.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Yeah.
Her English name is Alana, which is kind of an English name, kind of a Hebrew name. She had no idea if she even had a Hebrew name until a couple weeks ago. So it's not on our ksuba. So I spoke to Rabbi Yehuda Feil, and he basically said, since everybody knows her as Alana, so even though she had like a Hebrew name, so to speak, so her name is still like, maybe it's, I think her name.
Well, have you been, what is your name?
So,
oh, you don't know?
No, so we have no idea.
So then you should get a Hebrew name. I thought you actually knew.
No. So this is the thing. Like, I don't know. Like, so the story goes that my grandparents gave it to us in secrecy. My mother called up the synagogue trying to find out if there's any, like, paper trail. And they're saying there isn't.
You should get a name.
So
get on the phone.
Actually, what I was thinking of doing, would it be possible to do it in Israel?
I got to witness for people my last trip.
Oh, really?
Well, if we are, Esther, it's a good one. Just kidding, that's my daughter's name.
But then, wouldn't I be also disrespecting my grandparents by picking like a name after they gave me a name?
That's you don't have a name.
You don't know what it is.
It's been long.
Yeah, so that, yeah. so then it's not being disrespectful.
I got into touch for grad school, so master's in mathematics.
So taking control of your
own. Are they allowed?
No, they're
allowed.
That is great.
Yeah, and that would be, and then all of my, then the person who might have known, she also has to know.
She is 6 months.
For a couple days.
She has three teeth.
She's going back and forth.
Which is apparently, that's like a lot.
It's Scott.
I don't remember. So this is day number one for me, so.
I don't know.
She has three.
She's had his one go back. She's
awesome. I don't know if that's going on. Yeah.
That's
right.
Thank you.
We
should do it like a show.
Actually, we could do it at whichever shop is we're doing that over the trip.
Yeah, would that be okay?
What's that?
Because don't all the trips come together for Shabbos on the MG?
Yeah. Oh, you want to do it there?
Yeah.